Hi, my name is Quincy and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Quincy.
Thank you so much for the introduction. Oh, how cool. It's an old style tape recorder. That's so cute. No. I want to thank Layla so much for asking me to come up. It's always, always an honor and a privilege to do this. I don't ever take that for granted. It always cracks me up because they're always like, oh, let's go to dinner before the meeting. And then I stand up here and burp through the whole thing. It's really fantastic. But thank you so much for having me come up. I appreciate it. And welcome to all of you that are new and anybody who's celebrating birthdays and from out of town. And, you know, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous if you're new. I'm sure for you it feels like, oh, God, this is where my life has ended. But and I felt that way when I got here, too. But the truth is that I had no idea I was walking into the greatest experience of my life. I had no idea. And I'm super grateful for that. I want to thank my sponsee Heidi for coming with me and meeting us. And for the love of my life for being my partner in crime. On this. Really? Okay. Uh-huh. We'll see what that looks like when we get home. So, anyway, I'm just super grateful to be here. I am super, super happy to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. And, you know, there have been times in my sobriety that I have not always been super happy to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been like, really? This is what my life has amounted to, right? And the truth is that I wouldn't be who I am today. I wouldn't have the stuff that I have today. I wouldn't have anything if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous and for the program of Al-Anon, for those of you that identified as Al-Anon. You know, Al-Anons are, it's we're safe because there's a couple in here, and you can't have a meeting without at least one Al-Anon in the room because they'll take care of everything if everything goes crazy. But I love the program of Al-Anon, and I'm grateful for it. I will give you some important information so you can judge me properly. Before I give you judging information, I want to thank Trina for an amazing talk. Like, you know, we don't ever want to forget where we came from, right? Like, that's an incredible story, right? And we don't ever want to forget where we came from. And there is a reason we walk into these rooms and we tell the stories that we tell. It's not because it's like, oh, I'm going to see if my story is better than yours, right? That's really not the reason, even though we try to one-up each other all the time. But if I don't remember where I came from, I will go back there, you know? And it's super important. Not only that, like, identifying is huge. Like, if I walk into a room and I don't feel like I identify with you, why would I stay? Right? Why would it make sense to stay? And so that was a great talk. So thank you for your talk. So more about me. Okay. So my sobriety date is, what is it? February 1st, 1988. I was 7 when I got sober. And my home group is the Principles Before Personalities Big Book Study in Sherman Oaks, and my sponsor is Terry B. from San Diego. And, you know, I tell you those things only because when I came here, I didn't want anything to do with those things, right? Like, I was not looking to be honest, accountable, or responsible. Like, those were not on my list of things to do when I got here. And I really came here hoping that if I just cooled out for a little bit, everybody in my life would calm down, right? Go back to paying attention to themselves, right? And leave me alone. And I could go back to doing what I wanted. And that was really the belief system that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with. I grew up in Los Angeles. My dad's an alcoholic. He worked in the music business. And none of those things make me an alcoholic, but they helped. You know, and I grew up in a house where alcohol was a part of everything. Like, everything had alcohol attached to it. I mean, my chores had alcohol attached to it. Like, I had to walk to the corner with my little red wagon to get my father's alcohol for the week, and I usually got a candy bar for my efforts. So, like, even my chores involved alcohol. And you know, so I didn't know that the family I grew up in, I didn't know there was anything wrong with that. It didn't seem like anything was wrong with that. They just all seemed like a bunch of happy people. Naked, but they were happy, and it was great. You know, my father was my hero. He was the love of my life. He was my most favorite person on the planet, and I just wanted to be him, you know. And so I would go and I would sit in his studio and watch him paint these giant naked paintings of my mom and, you know, and listening to classical music at 8,000 decibels and, you know, the fireplace roaring and, you know, his glass of scotch on the rocks. And when he was finished with the scotch, he would give me the glass so that I could chew the rocks, right? Because I love to chew on ice. But I remember the flavor of the scotch-soaked rocks. And that was probably like one of my most favorite times with him, right? And so I had all these really great memories of what alcohol did for me. You know, it wasn't like I had an effect from it other than the connection that I had with my dad. And that was really where it started for me. You know, I don't remember my first drink because when you grow up in an alcoholic home, like, you know, I have pictures of me in diapers with a beer can tipped up. So like the first one I'm not really clear on, but I am really clear on my first drunk. And I remember it like it was yesterday because it was a night that changed my life, right? I was 12 and a half years old, and I have a cousin who's older than me, and she was graduating from high school, and she invited me to a party at her house. And I remember this night because I remember very distinctly who I was before this night and who I was after this night, right? And the kid that I was before this night was, you know, I was taller than everybody else. I had bigger boobs than everybody else. They haven't grown since, but we don't have to talk about that. But I just felt awkward. I felt uncomfortable. I felt like I didn't know that I didn't fit in, like I didn't have those words. I just felt like I was different than everybody else. And that feeling different was a level of conflict inside my body that I didn't know how to resolve. I had no skills to resolve that level of conflict. So it created, you know, a tremendous amount of anxiety, and it created a tremendous amount of emotional immaturity. And it was just awful, right? And so I remember going to this party, and I remember walking up the walk to this house, and and the whole way there, like my brain was on fire with, what are they going to think of me? Are they going to think I'm cute enough? Am I funny enough? Does my butt look cute in these jeans? Am I wearing the right clothes? Do I like the right bands? Like whatever it was, like I was 100% sure that you were thinking about me before I even got there. And so I wanted to make sure because I was so painfully awkward and so afraid of making a fool of myself or looking bad that I was just obsessed with, oh my God, what can I do to be perfect so that everybody likes me, you know? And when I walked into this party, there was all these older kids sitting around a card table playing quarters. And I had never played quarters in my life, but one of the greatest skills of being an alcoholic is you can walk into any situation and just adapt, right? And I walked in and I sat down at this table and I started playing quarters like I'd been playing all 12 years of my life. And it was great, right? Because the alcohol started to go into my system and everything started to feel different, right? Like my arms got lighter, my chest got lighter, and everything was really, really funny. But for the first time in my life, everything that was going on between my ears stopped. And it was that quiet. And that had never happened before. That had never happened before. And that was really the magic of alcohol for me. It made all of that conflict in here just go away, just disappear, you know? And I was happy about that, you know? Did I become a daily drinker at 12? No, don't be ridiculous. However, I did become obsessed from that point forward as to what did I have to do and where did I have to go and who did I have to hang out with to make that happen again? Because that was the solution to my life, right? My father's alcoholism got worse, right? He ended up having a grand mal seizure as a result of his drinking, and he ended up in rehab in 1981. And in 1981, it was still super not cool to be an alcoholic. Like, if you said you were an alcoholic, you were blackballed from any society that you were a part of. And he worked in the music business, and it was especially not cool to work in the music business and be an alcoholic. I mean, today it's super cool. Like, today you can have anything you want if you're an alcoholic in the music business, but back then it was not cool. And my mother became obsessed, like the Al-Anon that she is, with trying to get him sober and trying to help him, that she stopped really paying attention to the three of us, which was great for me because I was slipping out my window in the middle of the night, taking cabs from L.A. to Hollywood, you know, going clubbing every night. I became a Hollywood club kid, and I was just in the clubs every night, like doing drugs and drinking and hanging out with boys and doing stuff I wasn't supposed to do. And my, you know, I had arrived as far as I was concerned. Like my life had taken off. Well, this is exactly where I wanted to be. And And I started to experience some consequences, right? Like I started to, you know, get very tired, number one, but things started to happen to me, right? And I remember my mom came home, and after she had been at some Al-Anon meeting, and they said, you know, if you have kids, we have a program for kids with alcoholic parents. And I remember thinking, oh God, like, are you kidding? Like, I'm not going to sit around to talk about you people. Like, I can't think of anything more boring in my entire life. Like, I don't even like you people. Why would I talk about you, you know? And but I lost that battle because I was 12. And I just remember thinking, if I have to go to this stupid meeting with these dumb kids, like, I'm just going to be as stoned as I can stand. And you know, then I won't really be in the room, right? And the whole way there, I was like, I'm not going to this meeting. Like, I will go sit in a bush. I will go for a walk, right? I will go rob a liquor store, but I am not going to this meeting. Like, this is just not happening, right? And my mom pulls up in front of the church, and there's all these, you know, teenagers playing outside. And I looked out the window, and I saw the most beautiful boy I had ever seen in my entire life. And I went to Alateen religiously for the next 7 years. Right? Because this is a program of attraction rather than promotion, right? We don't really care what attracts you, just stay, you know? And it was great. Like, we would go and we would sit in these meetings and we would talk about what a hot mess our parents were and all the crazy crap they were doing, and then we would go try it. And, you know, when you're in Alateen, there's only two ways to go. You're either going to Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was shooting for the big room, you know, and because y'all were laughing all the time. And that's where I wanted to be. And I, you know, ever since I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous, I love listening to the stories of alcoholics. I just do. I love the stories of alcoholics. I love hearing, you know, the things that we have overcome and the people that we have become as a result of walking through this process. And it's amazing, you know, it's just amazing. And so I started going to that meeting, and, you know, and I was going to these Alateen meetings as my drinking career is taking off, right? And my mom, who thought, well, she's with the AAs, right? She's with Alcoholics Anonymous. She's safe. That's so funny. So nothing wrong with, like, putting her 13-year-old daughter on a train from L.A. to San Diego to go to the SoCal convention with a couple $100 in her pocket. Now, if you're anything like me and you have a flourishing alcoholism problem happening, like, and you're going to an AA convention to be in a hotel room with 16 other Alateens, right? What do you think we did? Right? The fact that we ended up drunk, butt naked, covered in shaving cream at an AA convention really shouldn't shock anybody in this room. You know? And that was just what my alcoholism looks like when it's working, right? Like, you put alcohol in this body and I lose the power of choice over what's going to happen next. And it's really funny because I grew up in a house where there was a lot of drunk, naked people. I didn't know you could drink and not get naked. Like, I thought that was just a thing. Like, you drink, you get naked. Like, that's just how it goes, right? And so I was naked everywhere, right? And hello, I'm naked again. And I would come to naked, like, in front of me and Heidi's, like, the first time I ever met Wes. I was best friends with his sister, and it was the same year. And I came to butt naked under a glass coffee table with this guy going, right? And I was like, how did I get here? And he loves to share that story from the podium, so I thought I'd beat him to it. But that was just what it looked like for me. Like, the drink would take me every time, you know? And let's be clear, like, when you're drinking at 12 years old, 13 years old, you're drinking for the effect. I was drinking for the effect. Like, social drinking at 13 is not a thing, right? Like, that's not a thing. And so it wasn't about being a teetotaler. It was always about, how do I get out of my body? Because the second I realized that alcohol was the solution to my conflict, that was all I thought about. And I didn't care how I ended up. I didn't care where I ended up. I didn't care who I was with. Just get me out of my body, you know, and it did every time. I started blacking out, which for me was perfect, because if you can't remember what happened, you're not responsible. That was the way I thought anyway. And you know, I woke up in an alley one night, and I knew that what was happening to me wasn't normal, right? I knew that the consequences that were showing up in my life at 15 weren't normal. And the only reason I knew that was because I had listened to AAs. I had listened to the alcoholics share their experience, strength, and hope from the podium and talk about what their alcoholism looked like, right? But I didn't really know what it meant to be an alcoholic. I thought being an alcoholic was based in consequences, right? I didn't know. I didn't know about the physical part of it. I didn't know about the mental part of it, and I didn't know about the spiritual malady. But I was pretty clear that I was having some issues that my friends were not having, right? They weren't waking up naked in, you know, parking structures in Santa Monica. They weren't waking up naked in the backseat of somebody's car. They have no idea who it was. You know, like, that wasn't happening for them. And because I'd been around Alcoholics Anonymous, I decided to get sober. So I thought, right? I thought, oh, I'm just going to get sober. And I came in here falling victim to the belief that if I just got rid of the drugs and the alcohol, that everything would be fine, right? That everything would be fine. Like, the problem is the drugs and the alcohol. Like, if I just get rid of that, everything will be fine. But if you're anything like me, it gets worse, not better, right? As soon as I let go of my solution of drugs and alcohol, all of that conflict that lived in the middle of my body came rushing back to the surface and started running my life, right? The lying, the cheating, the stealing, the manipulating, like, all of that stuff came rushing to the surface and was creating quite a mess, as you can imagine, in my life. And I couldn't blame it on being drunk. I couldn't blame it on not being there, right? I could blame it on you, because let's be clear, it's you, not me. And I started to, you know, I started to get uncomfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I came here thinking, I'm 15 and a half years old, right? I don't need a God. What do you mean, some old white guy, have in common anyway, right? So why would I read the big book, right? I don't need a sponsor, because I don't need anybody suggesting to me what I could do differently. I'm good. I got this, right? And so I came in here a victim of myself, really, right? And limiting my ability to be different, right? Because I thought I knew, right? So I stayed sober for almost 2 years, but then I copped a resentment at somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, because how hard is that to do, right? And then I built a case, right? Any case builders in here? Anybody else like to build a case, right? Oh, y'all are case builders, you bunch of liars. And because let me tell you, if I can build a case about why I'm right about how wrong you are, I don't have to be different. I just have to get rid of you. Right? And I'm really good at that. Clip! Like, I used to just, bink, people would just disappear from my life, you know? But I was really good at being right about how wrong you were, right? Not realizing that that's how my sickness manifested, right? And I started to build a case about, like, well, I've never had a legal drink in my life. How could I actually be an alcoholic? Like, I'm not even old enough to drink at this point, right? Like, it was probably just a phase. I mean, seriously, it's like, you know, I had an accident, right? Like, I peed in my pants 80 times. That's an accident. And, yeah, because that's normal for a 15-year-old. And so I decided that I didn't really need to be here. Y'all were drama queens and gossip mongers, and I was too, but we're not talking about me. We are talking about you. And I walked away from Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And in 20 minutes, I was out and off to the races one more time. And anybody who's in this room who's ever been drunk and then sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and then gone back out knows how hard it is to get drunk with all those happy, shiny AA people in your head. They're annoying, right? And it takes a tremendous amount of booze to get rid of them. Like, tremendous, right? And so I went from blacking out here and there once in a while to blacking out for almost the entire 6 months I was out there. Because the amount of drunk I had to stay just to deal with the shame, just to deal with the overwhelming, you know, all-incumbent shame that came as a result of one more time being in that place of not being able to function, not being able to be here, not being able to do anything, and not wanting to be here, not wanting to be me, not understanding what was really happening. That shame, that level of shame, was staggering, right? And the only way I could get out of it was to just be gone, you know? I came to on February 1st of 1988, pissed off. Like, I was mad, right? Like, I don't even remember, but I just remember waking up mad. And I was mad because I just didn't want to be here. I could not stay drunk enough to die, and I could not stay drunk enough to make it work. Like, I could not find the balance, right? And I was, the night before I had had a party for a girl I couldn't stand, because any reason to have a party is a reason to have a party. And I don't really remember what happened that night, but I do have like a moment, this gray, brown, whatever color you want to call it, moment, where I remember some guy trying to have his way with me, and I had absolutely no defense against trying to get him away from me, except to throw up on him, and I'm not even sure that worked, right? And that was where it was. Like, that's where it was for me. And that's another level of shame that is just, you know, how do you reconcile that? What do you do with that, right? So when I woke up that day, I said a prayer that I believe every alcoholic says at some point or another. It's how we end up here. And that prayer was, help me. Now, I don't know who I said that to. I don't know where that came from. My father was an atheist at best, right? And my religious upbringing consisted of me saying to him, who's God? He said he was. That was the end of it, okay? And so I had no understanding of a power greater than me. I had no understanding about any of it. But I said that prayer to the universe, you know? And then I, you know, proceeded to detox for a couple of days, right? And my mom, being the beautiful, wonderful Al-Anon that she is, finally, you know, kicked my door down and said, you know, you need to go to a meeting. And I just remember thinking, oh no, not those people. Yeah, no, not those people again, right? I'm fine, I can do this by myself. But again, if you're anything like me, I can't stand my own company, so I put on my best outfit and went to a meeting. And somehow y'all knew I was new. Not sure if it was the Daisy Dukes or the bikini top or the candies I was wearing, but y'all knew I was new, and y'all were super, super nice to me. And I was really, really lucky that I landed in a group of people where everybody that I was hanging out with was the same age as me. I was 18 years old, and I was beat up. Right, I was beat up, and I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know how to function, you know. Right. But I landed in this group, and there was a whole bunch of us around the same age, and they just grabbed onto me and dragged me from place to place to place to place. Like, they didn't let me, you know, they didn't let grass grow under my feet. They just kept taking me from place to place to place. And thank God, because, you know, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, even if you're old to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I hope that you have a posse of people that are holding on to you, right? That are holding on to you and making sure that you're still here. Because the truth is this A&A stuff takes a while to sink in. Like, you don't get here and it doesn't sink in as fast as a drink does, right? It takes a while for this stuff to make sense, for this stuff to be applied, for this stuff to even register as to what in the hell we're even talking about, right? So in between those moments of when it's sinking in and when it's not, we need each other to hold on to each other, just like Trina was talking about, to hold on to each other, just to keep each other here. And the thing that was so awful about COVID was, not only were we not in the same rooms with each other, but it was really hard to tell who wasn't here anymore, right? Really hard. And how do you find somebody that you don't know where they are, right? And it's crucial. It's crucial that we recognize who's in the room, who's not in the room. It's why we have greeters at the door. It's so important for us to all feel like we belong here. Like, I've never felt like I didn't belong here, ever, right? I may not identify with you. I may not even like you, right? But I never felt like I didn't belong here. And I cherish that moment. And I think everybody in this room should have that feeling. Everybody should know that regardless of how you may feel about us, you're welcome here. And that's super important, you know? You know, I started having a great time in Alcoholics Anonymous with all my new friends. And this crusty old-timer. You guys have got a couple of them in here. I know you do. I see you. I see you, old-timers. I'm one of you now, too, but we don't need to talk about me. But this crusty old-timer walked right up to me, right? I'm just being some punk kid, just having too much fun, laughing too loudly. I so related when you said, you know, I needed a lot of attention. It was very dramatic. I mean, that was just last week for me. But yes, I totally related. And I was definitely that kid when I got sober. And this old timer walked right up to me and he's like, hey, you. And I said, what? He goes, you need a job. I was like, whoa, old guy. Whoa. I didn't ask you. right? He goes, oh, no. You need a job. He said, you have way too much time on your hands, and if you don't get a job, you're going to get drunk. He scared me to death. Like, scared, I mean, I was like, does he have a crystal ball? Like, what is, how does he know that, right? And I didn't know what to do, right? Like, I was 19 years old, didn't have a high school diploma, couldn't find my ass with both hands. Like, I had, what do you do when those are your qualifications, right? And I had a friend who was working in rehab, or who was in a rehab at the time, and she had invited me to this rehab so she could make amends to me. And I went to this rehab, you know, and there's all these people sitting around talking about AA and talking about the 12 steps. And I'm like, well, I could do that. I'm like, how hard could that be? I can talk to people all day long about anything, right? I've never read the book. I've never seen the steps, but I'll talk to you about it all day long, right? And so I applied for this job and they gave me a job. But on the application, it said, what's your sobriety date, right? And I thought, well, I don't remember that 6 months. How will you, right? Like, this is the funniest thing ever, right? This is the honor system amongst liars, cheaters, and thieves, right? It's not like Layla standing at the door going, so-and-so's got this many days, and so-and-so's got that many days, right? You're as sober as you tell us you are, right? You could be lying your face off. We can't do a thing about it, right? Can't do a thing about it. And I remember thinking, you know, if they thought I had more time, they'd give me a better job. So I put down my original sobriety date, right? And which would have given me 3 years, right, at the time. I was like, yeah, I mean, you weren't there. Nobody was there. Well, maybe they weren't there, but whatever, right? So they gave me a job, and thank God, right, because I went from having too much time on my hands to working 12 to 16 hours a day, strapping kids to beds, throwing them in the druggy buggy, taking them to a different meeting every night, you know, like it was perfect, right? Because I was never in the same place twice. We never, in LA, there's like 8,000 meetings a day. And so like we all never went to the same meeting twice. So it was great because I was like smoke in Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody knew me, right? Nobody, you know, like nobody was keeping track. Nobody had any idea what was going on with me. I could just do whatever I wanted, you know? But then on February 1st of 1989, I'm driving to work at like 5 o'clock in the morning. And all of a sudden dawns on me that I have like a year sober. I was like, oh my God, like where did the time go? Like how did that happen? Like I wasn't planning on staying here that long, right? But I was sort of locked in at this point. Like I had a whole bunch of friends. They liked to see me, you know. They kept inviting me places. They remembered my name, you know, important things. And I was like, how do I reconcile this, right? So here's that conflict again, right? That overwhelming anxiety, that toxic insecurity, right? That unbridled emotional immaturity, wham, all of a sudden it's back, right? All of a sudden, right? And it was probably there all along, but because I'm practicing some defects, it was even stronger, right? And how do you resolve that? Now, I don't have a sponsor because, you know, what do I need one of those for, right? And so I'm not running my thinking by anybody saying, does this sound like a good idea, right? Because why would I do that? So I thought, well, I'll just get drunk after work, right? Because that makes sense. Right? Like, if I get drunk after work, then I'm just this poor, pathetic drunk. Like, oh, poor Quincy can't stay sober. And that's way okay. You guys are totally okay with that, right? But if I'm a liar, you might throw me out of A&A. Because I didn't think anybody else was a liar. I just thought only I was a liar, right? So this is my plan. And I'm very depressed about it because I sense I'm not being all too smart. But I'm going to go through with it, right? So I go into work, and there's this girl I've never seen before, and she looks at me, and she goes, oh, my God, you look like hell. I was like, oh, nice to meet you, too. She said, what is the matter with you? I said, well, I have a year sober today. She goes, oh, my God, you should be so excited. You should be over the moon. What is the matter with you? She goes, that's great, 1 year. Somebody over here had 1 year. Like, 1 year is a big deal. It's huge. Like, that's a bigger deal than any of the rest of them, right? It's the biggest deal ever, right? 1 year. We did something for a whole year. And she was all excited for me, and she goes, what is the matter with you? And I said, well, everybody here just saw me take a cake for 4 years a month ago. Oh, yeah, she thought that shit was just as funny as you all. And I'm like, this is not funny. Like, this is my life we're talking about. She goes, oh, Quincy. She goes, trust me. She goes, nobody is thinking about you. Wait a minute, what? Like, that was even more devastating than the first laugh, right? And I tell that story because it talks about, in the back of the big book, it talks about how honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness are the essentials for recovery. Essentials, right? Which means you cannot recover without them, right? But there's a huge difference between physical sobriety and mental, emotional, and spiritual recovery. They're not the same. It would take me a decade and a half to find out that they're not the same, right? Because you can come into Alcoholics Anonymous and get physically sober. Not that that's easy, it's not, but it's the easier part than the other part, right? You can get physically sober, and you'll never be any more physically sober than you are when you're more than like 6 months sober, right? Like, sure, okay. Every cell in your body regenerates in 7 years. So I've regenerated, what, 5 times already? Like, I should be as sober gets, right? So what is the rest of this whole thing about, right? It's the other part, right? But I don't understand the other part, right? So anyway, I don't know if you're like me, but when I do something good, like tell the truth for the first time in spite of myself, right, I think I deserve a reward, right? Like a cookie, or maybe a pair of shoes, possibly a boyfriend. And I picked out my reward, and I had to have him. But they don't really like it when you date the patients. So I had to get a new job, right? Because, I mean, that's easy, right? I'll just get a new job, right? And so I had to have him, and me and the newcomer, we're going to move in with each other, right? You all know how this story goes, right? Anybody lived through this one? Yeah. Liars. Yeah. Oh, there you go. There's my man back there, right? Me and the newcomer, we're going to move in together. And the day we're supposed to move in, right, I had rounded up all my stuff at my mom's house. I'm driving to the new house. I get to the new house. We signed a lease, like we were super excited. Get to the house, and there's a post-it note on the door. Sorry, babe, split town with my pregnant ex-girlfriend. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so if you're dating a newcomer, good luck with that. And I lost my mind, right? Like snots flying, tears, hair. I'm like, oh my God, what do I do? Like I was losing it, right? My friend goes, you know what you need? And I said, no, tell me anything. She goes, you need a sponsor. I was like, oh my God, do you know one? She goes, yeah, my stepmom, she's a sponsor. I'm like, take her to me. Like, take her to, they take me to her right away, right? Like she's a genie who's just going to go, everything's fixed, right? So I get to her house and I'm like snotting and crying all over her. And I'm like, I don't have a boyfriend. I don't have anybody. I don't have to die. You know, like typical newcomer drama, right? It's fantastic. She says, I have the perfect job for you. I'm like, anything. I'll do anything. I said, I don't care. I'll do anything. I'm in deep trouble. She said, well, Quincy, she said, I think you should be a stripper. I was like, okay. Right? Because look, you have to remember, I'm 20 years old at this point, right? I'm not even old enough to be a stripper, but that's a whole other conversation, right? And she says, you know, and because she's somebody in AA, and that, I thought that was an AA suggestion. Right? Like this blonde hair is not just dyed, I'm just saying, right? Like I was so dense, I did not know that that was not what an AA suggestion was. Because look, I'm not reading the book. I don't have a sponsor. She's as close to a sponsor as I've ever had at this point, right? And if she said, go be a stripper, I was like, well, that's an AA suggestion, right? So I went and did that and had the time of my life, right? Had the time, I learned how to be a lady, actually, because I was quite a tomboy before that. And you actually have to be presentable in those kind of places. Well, sort of. And you have to do some things. And it was great. I hooked up with all the other sober strippers and we had a great time and learned how to play pool and hustled pool all over the state of California and Arizona and Nevada. Made a ton of money. Like we had a great time, right? But again, like I don't have a sponsor, right? I'm not running my thinking by anybody. I'm not saying, hey, does this sound like a good idea, right? So when my best friend, who was the lead stripper in this club, decided to leave the business and join the circus, true story, and her boyfriend that she was leaving behind, who hated me because she knew that I always covered for her, right? Or he knew I always covered for her. And he came up to me and said, you know, you and I should talk. We should, you know, clear the air between us. You all know how that ends, right? Do I really need to get into all that, right? You know, we mended some fences and then we mended some other things. And And let's be clear, like, there are rules amongst strippers and hoes, right? Which is that you do not sleep with your friend's boyfriend, whether she likes him or not, right? So I went from making $1,000 a day to making $7 a day, right? And even in 1994, living in my mama's house, $7 a day was not enough, right? So what do you do when you're a used up stripper hoe? Like, where do you go with those qualifications, right? Well, I went into real estate, like any good stripper. And I would love to tell you that, like, I figured this out, right? Like, that I figured out I was, my problem-solving skills were not up to par, right? And I was like, oh, I keep making the same mistakes. I keep blowing up my life, right? I have now had to pull at least, I think at this point I had pulled 2 geographics in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Because the greatest part about getting sober in LA is there's so many meetings and there's so many people and there's so much traffic that if you get sober on one side of the hill and you go to meetings on another side of the hill, nobody's driving in traffic to service that resentment. Nobody, right? So I could pull a geographic in LA and nobody would ever see me again, right? Problem solved. Because that's how I solve my problems. I create a mess, I build a case about why you're the reason the mess created, and then I get rid of the mess, right? Done, right? And I did this a couple of times, right? And I think the last time I did it was, I was 12, almost 13 years sober. And I was, one more time, I had created a mess, right? I had a sponsor. I had a sponsor for like 3 years. I talked to her 3 times. Will you give me a cake? Will you give me a cake? Will you give me a cake? Like all 3 of those years. That was the only time I talked to her. And so right around this time, I was like, it's happening again. People are talking badly about me in meetings. I'm starting to hear the rumors. People are not being nice to me, right? Woe is me, right? And I'm like, it's you people, right? It's again, like one more time, it's these damn AA people, right? But not only is it the AA people, it's AA, period, right? Now I'm building a case against AA, because at this point, I'm 13 years sober, and my life is no different, except that I remember every horrible moment of it, right? At least when I was drunk, I didn't remember anything, right? But in sobriety, I humiliated myself and demoralized myself just as much in sobriety as I did out there drinking and using. Because when you don't have any skills to deal with stuff anyway else, you will use what you know, right? My old grand sponsor used to say, my character defects are my best attempt at getting my needs met. And that was always the case for me, right? So I start building a case and I said, I'm going to go to this meeting to say goodbye to my sponsor, because God forbid I leave without anybody noticing. And and I went to this meeting, right? And I walked into this room, and it's a big book study. And I mean, let's be clear, I had never gone to a big book study in 13 years, because quite frankly, hot guys didn't go to big book studies, so why would I go? And I mean, that's a thing. And so, but I walk into this room, and there's all these old timers. And I'm like, oh God, here we go, right? And there's this crusty old guy, the front of the room, reading 5 pages out of the book, right? And I'm sitting there in my chair with my arms crossed and my, you know, don't stay away from me stare. And it was a sniper meeting, right? Where they just pick on people like, you share, right? And he saw my happy ass and he's all, hey, you happy pants, why don't you share? And I vomit all over this meeting about how much I hate Alcoholics Anonymous and I hate you people and I don't want to be here and this crap doesn't work and blah, 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 blah. I mean, you have to be really sick to be that crazy and 13 years dry to be that crazy. And I just vomited all over the meeting, all of my disease, all of my yuck, all over you, right? Because that was one thing I did learn at Alcoholics Anonymous is go to a meeting and tell on yourself. And thank God I had at least that skill. And at the end of the meeting, this other crusty old timer walked up to me and he put his hand on my arm and he said, Quincy, he said, AA is full of sick people. Do not expect them to act well. And I was like, what did he just say? Like he gave me permission to be wrong, right? Because I knew that not only was he talking about you, because obviously, but he was talking about me too, right? Like, I had been walking around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous carrying the disease of alcoholism because I had no clue what it was. I believed this was about drugs and alcohol. And if the drugs and alcohol, I mean, I'm a mathematician for crying out loud. If you get rid of the drugs and alcohol, the problem should be gone, right? The problem is that alcoholism is an algebraic equation, right? And I'm not good at algebra, right? I suck at algebra. And my other, you know, the moral to my, the message of my story, don't go to meetings where there's old timers because they will save your life when you don't want them to, right? And they did. And the next person that walked up to me was the craziest, scariest person I've ever met in my entire life. And she was crazy scary because she was the kind of person whose whole deportment shouted that she had a real answer. And I'd spent my whole life staying away from people with a real answer because I didn't want one, right? But she didn't care. She walked right through my force field and she shoved her card in my hand and she said, I'm really good at doing column works and helping people with resentments. And if you want to get free of those things, I can help you. And I was like, what resentments is she talking about? I don't even know what she's talking about. I don't have any resentments. I didn't even know what a resentment was, to be honest. I was so out of my mind, I didn't even know I was riddled with resentment. So I called the crazy scary lady, and because something just said, call the crazy scary lady, and I called her. And she gave me some directions. She said, just write down who and why you're mad. Who you're mad at and why you're mad at them, and then come to my house. And this is usually where I put in my 30-second commercial of, you know, there's really only one wrong way to do Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's to not do it, right? It's the only wrong way to do Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody in here will go through the steps, will go through the big book, will go through whatever, the process, differently, with a different level of education, with a different level of experience, with a different level of interpretation, right? And every one of them is right. You know, I have to remember, you know, I have been the asshole at the front of the room who said, if you're not doing AA this way, you're not doing Alcoholics Anonymous. And that kills alcoholics, right? Because we're the kind of people that we think if we're not doing it right, well, I'm not doing it at all then, right? And that happens a lot, right? But the truth is that when we walk into these rooms, and if we are just seeking, no matter what that seeking looks like, we're doing the right thing, right? I mean, I look at what I wouldn't suggest to anybody to stay sober the way I did in the first 13 years. Like, I would never recommend that to anybody. But I also know that I could not have gotten sober any other way, right? I could not have run into this crazy lady when I ran into her any sooner than I did. Because at 13 years sober, I was so beat up and I was only as desperate as the dying could be by being 13 years dry and out of my mind, right? And so then I became willing to do this like nobody else had done it, right? You know, look, the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer is freedom. That's it, right? Like, that's all we're here for. I'm sorry if you're here for the cash and prizes, you're in the wrong door. But that's really the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous is offering, is freedom. Right? And don't worry, if that's not what you're looking for, it's not like it's going to come to your house and knock on your door and say, hi, I'm freedom, I'm here for you. You know, like, it takes a tremendous amount of work and willingness. And the nastiest six-letter word in the big book is effort, right? It takes effort, right? Which, I don't know about you, but this alcoholic hates that word, right? It's almost as bad as the other six-letter word, which is victim, right? Those two words. Ooh, they're just nasty. But those are the things that keep me the sickest. My lack of effort and my willingness to be a victim, right? Anyway, she took me through the column work, and when she did, she showed me her interpretation of the column work, and she had seven columns at the time. So it doesn't matter if you have four columns, if you have five columns, if you have 100 columns. I don't care how many columns is in your inventory. Just do it. If it works for you, just do it, right? And, you know, my only caveat to saying that there's only one wrong way to do this is, you know, if you've been through the 12 steps and you've been through the big book and you haven't experienced the level of freedom that the big book promises, just ask somebody else to take you through until you get there. That's all you have to do. You don't have to go out and get loaded. You don't have to go out and create drama, which I love to do, but you don't have to do that, right? You just ask somebody else to take you through until you get to that place. Because sometimes we forget, yes, we're here to be freed from the obsession of drugs and alcohol, which is another word for freedom, right? That's the opposite of that, right? But what does that look like? And we forget what we're pursuing here, right? Like, I came here and I was 100% clear on the fact that when I put drugs and alcohol in this body, I lose the power of choice. I understood the physical allergy to alcohol clearly. Clearly. That part was the easy part. But understanding the mental obsession and the spiritual malady, I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea what that meant, you know? My mental obsession with thinking I know how to solve problems was obscene, right? Like, I thought I could solve all my problems with my thinking, right? But let's be clear, you cannot solve a problem with the same brain that created the problem, right? That doesn't work, right? And also, you know, so I didn't understand the mental obsession, and it would take going through the big book and going through the 12 steps and going through the inventory process to understand where my thinking is wrong, where my thinking is off, so I could be different. Y'all aren't never going to be different, right? Y'all are the best versions of you are ever going to be, ever, for me, right? You're just who you are. You're never going to be different. So the only person I can make different is me. That's it. That's the good news and the bad news, by the way. But, like, that's the only one I can make different, right? The spiritual malady part, I really didn't understand, right? Because I don't understand any of the spiritual stuff. And they talk about all this God stuff, and, you know, people flip out about it. And I don't usually talk about it. But the spiritual malady stuff doesn't have to be any more complicated than it's me separating myself from the universe and for anybody that's on it, anybody that's in it. That's all the spiritual malady is. If I can build a case about why I'm right about how wrong you are, that's separating. If I'm judging you, that's separating. If I'm justifying and rationalizing why I'm behaving the way I am, who cares if it's hurting you? That's separating, right? If I'm resenting you for the stuff you did to me and making myself a victim, that's separating. It's making myself worse than or better than. And I didn't understand any of that until I went through the big book with her, until I went through the inventory process, I went through the steps, and I started taking other people through that process. Like, it's one thing to do the process on yourself, right? You know, sit and talk about me all day long. Of course. How boring could that be? Right? But to take somebody else through the process is when you really learn. That's when you learn. You know, they used to say, in order to keep it, you have to get it, give it away. In order to get it at all, you have to get it away. Give it away. Because you don't know what you know until you try to explain it to somebody else. You know, I'll say this and sit down. She gave me three really important things. She said, you are responsible for your happiness. She said, nobody is responsible for your happiness. If you aren't happy, if you're upset, if you're bothered, it's on you. Nobody has that power unless you give it to them. So get in here, do the work, figure out why you're giving it to them so you can get back to happy, joyous, and free. Again, good news, bad news, right? She said, you're also responsible for your recovery. She said, if you want what I have, she said, you better chase me like I owe you money. Right? And I did. I chased that woman everywhere she went. I called her all the time. I chased her. I went to meetings she went to. The only thing I couldn't do was ask her questions because I didn't know how to. But boy, she taught me how to. I'd call her. We all have this sponsee that calls and, like, talks to you for 5 minutes without even saying hi, right? Hi, blah, 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 this is what's going on with me, blah, blah, blah. And she'd go, okay, click, and she'd hang up on me. And I'd be like, oh, my God, she doesn't like me, right? Like, my sponsor doesn't like me. This is bad, right? And I finally got the courage to say, you know, do you not like me? She goes, oh, no, Quincy, I like you fine. She said, but you never invite me into the conversation. She said, you have conversations at me, not with me. She said, if you want what I have, she said, how do you think you're going to get it by telling me what's going on with you? She goes, I don't care. She said, I didn't ask you to sponsor me. You asked me to sponsor you. Ask questions. And she said, you have to ask questions every time you call. So I didn't call for 3 weeks. And she said, I thought we were clear on how this was going to go. And I said, well, I don't have a question. And she goes, Quincy, there's a question on, like, every page of the big book. Just pull one out of there. She said, just ask me, what could I have said differently? What do you see differently? How could I have done this differently? Anything. She said, ask me anything. Just invite me into the conversation. And that changed my life. That's what a true third step is being willing to admit that my way of thinking and my way of doing doesn't work. And the only way to flip that around is to ask somebody else how they do it, right? The last thing she told me is she said, Quincy, you are responsible for carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. She goes, nobody cares about the Quincy show. This is not about you. She said, you can be funny and cute all you want. She said, but it's not about you. At the end of the day, at the end of your talk, you want people to know that Alcoholics Anonymous works, that you have an amazing life as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that it's available for them too. Hopefully that's what I did. Thank you.